Welcome to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue this morning. Joe's scheduled to return on Friday. Don't worry about him. He'll tell you where he's been when he comes back. He usually does. Doesn't he? Our dear darling listeners. You can join the conversation this morning by emailing us panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We also want to mention the Roundtable is going on the road with, of course, WAMC on the road. This coming Monday, May 4th from 9 to 11 a.m. We will be broadcasting from Olana in Hudson, New York, Frederick Church's Olana, celebrating the 200th anniversary of the birthday of Frederick Church. And we moved around some tickets. There are a few available at WAMC.org. It's $25 a ticket if you want to come watch a live broadcast and hang out with us at the beautiful historic site in the Hudson Valley known as Olana. You can visit again WAMC.org and find links on our events drop-down menu, or if you scroll down, you'll see the On the Road link, and you can find more information there. That's WAMC.org. And thank you. The panel this morning, here we go. Ready, everybody?
Yep.
Thank you. Thanks, Jackie. The guys nodded. We are here with, you heard from first, lecturer of cognitive sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and former Fulbright U.S. scholar to Egypt, Jackie Barry. Welcome back, Jackie. It's my first go-around with you. Thanks for coming in.
Yes, and thank you so much for having me, and thank you for being our fearless leader this morning, Sarah.
Oh, who said I was fearless?
Okay.
I might be full of fear, but I will lead nonetheless.
And thank you.
Again, thanks for being here. It's great to see you. We're also joined by Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning. I am good.
Yeah?
Yeah, I am. Actually,
do you have any special days to tell us about?
Yeah, actually, today is National Zipper Day. It's supposedly a celebration of the gift of the zipper. I celebrated by wearing pants, if anybody is interested. So,
we appreciate it.
I am,
thank you. I appreciate
yes.
Wearing pants today.
So today, mind your zipper and celebrate.
All right.
And I think Joe was invited to the White House event last night.
So, you think so?
Yeah. So if you see Joe, ask him how he did with the king.
We're just starting rumors.
And that's how rumors start.
For no reason. All right, Bob. I'll have to watch you for the rest of the show.
Ziplocs? Does that include Ziplocs?
I think that we could be absolutely expansive. Okay. Zip ties, Ziplocs.
All right.
Anything that zips. Zip lips would be nice, but not on the show. Not while we're broadcasting. I need you all to keep talking, please. Also in studio, investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Sarah. It's almost spring. Maybe it'll arrive someday.
Someday.
It was spring. It was definitely spring on Sunday. It was almost summer.
We got a head fake a couple weeks ago, right? A couple of 70-degree days. We thought we were in the clear, and then we're not quite back there again yet.
No, but we don't have any control over it. So you have to accept. That's my advice. You're looking at me like you don't appreciate my advice, and so I apologize.
I just once again realize your wisdom, even though it's sobering.
All right. And our last but certainly not least final panelist of this morning is lawyer, negotiator, and advisor to companies, nonprofits, law firms, and business leaders, founder of the strategy consulting firm The Azara Group, and author of Race Rules, What Your Black Friends Won't Tell You, Fatima Gilliam. Hello, Fatima. Nice to talk to you.
Hi. Hello, everybody. I'm happy to be here. And like Mark, it's cold. It's still cold. And having grown up in California, like, I am desperate for some consistent sun that comes with some heat.
All right. Well, I can't promise it, of course, but the months coming up are the ones that usually have it. So we'll all keep our fingers crossed that we get a spring and summer soon. Let us jump into our first topic of this morning. Again, you can join the conversation by emailing us panel@wamc.org. We're going to talk about free speech as it pertains to late night television. Yes, again, this from the AP. Donald and Melania Trump both called for ABC to fire Jimmy Kimmel on Monday after a joke last week in which the late night comic described the first lady as having, quote, the glow of an expectant widow, unquote. The remark about the president's wife was part of a routine on Thursday's Jimmy Kimmel Live, where the host pretended to deliver a comedy routine at a faux White House Correspondents Association dinner. That event, two nights later, the real Correspondents Dinner, as we all know, was cut short when a man armed with guns and knives tried to enter the Washington ballroom where the Trumps and much of the nation's political leadership had gathered. Melania Trump said in a social media post, later echoed by her husband, quote, "People like Kimmel shouldn't have the opportunity to enter our homes each evening to spread hate." Kimmel described the joke during his Monday night monologue as a light roast of the first couple's age difference and not, quote, "by any stretch of the definition, a call to assassination," end quote. He said he was very sorry that the president and everyone at the correspondents' dinner went through the traumatic and scary experience. He also said, quote, "Again, I agree that hateful and violent rhetoric is something we should reject. I do, and I think a great place to start to dial that back would be to have a conversation with your husband about it," that, of course, directed at the First Lady regarding the president. There was no comment on Monday from ABC. Today is Wednesday. ABC doesn't seem to be moving like they did last time. Let's discuss. Do you want to start, Mark?
Sure. If you heard Kimmel's comments last night, he effectively doubled down. And when you, at the end of your remarks, mentioned that ABC doesn't seem to be moving against Kimmel, I presume that Kimmel, in one way or another, took the read of the room before he hit the airwaves last night. So I suspect his doubling down represents an implicit or even explicit clearance from the powers at Disney. And remember, the CEO there just changed. So I got a feeling Kimmel got waved through or feels he will be waved through on this one, which is the right answer. Brendan Carr, the head of the FCC, trying to use it as a political cudgel is absurd. It should be illegal if it isn't. The last time the FCC, what they're threatening to do is ABC, which is a content producer, also owns a number of stations. So sort of like when McDonald's, which is a franchise, or happens to own some of the selective franchisees. And what Carr is doing is threatening those licenses. The last time that was done was in 1969. There was a Jackson, Mississippi station that all but promulgated the continuation of segregation in the United States, wouldn't let African-American leaders on the air. And they eventually lost their public license, and rightfully so. What Kimmel's doing doesn't even get close to that. It shows how Trump is effectively trying to continue to change the media landscape, which he's already altered dramatically. Let's just go through the hits, if you will. He starts by calling it fake news. And basically the old gatekeepers are gone. We've now got this media infrastructure of the Candace Owens of the world, who are entirely unfiltered. I don't think she's got a legal department or any fact checkers on her broadcast. There's this horrible feedback loop with Fox News, where literally what's on the news is part of what affects what he does. He's got the mass media now coalescing into the hands of his partners, which he's somewhat, including the Ellerson family. He's helped that along with this dance he did around TikTok, not entirely clear if he followed the letter of the law in terms of finding that a new set of owners in the United States. The tech bros that were up on the dais with him during his inauguration are all playing nice so that they can keep the inside lane on AI while he's president, because they believe that's so important. And he continues to follow the Steve Bannon adage of just flood the zone with nonsense. And we see that every day, whether it be – and I can't tell what he's trying to distract from what these days, whether it's the Epstein files or the war in Iran. But clearly, with Comey and Kimmel, he's busy using this tool that he has reshaped in this country dramatically and helped accelerate the reshaping of. And we're all the worse for it, I believe, in aggregate.
Jackie.
Yeah, so it's unfortunate that he said that. I don't think it was a good joke, to be honest. I don't think I would have laughed. But that's what comedians do, right? They poke fun at public figures to make us laugh. And that's the price of being a public figure, is you're going to potentially have aspects of your life made a joke about or even be parodied on SNL. And that's part of the game. That's part of what you're you have to come up against. Trump is very sensitive to that. He takes himself very seriously. He does not like to be the brunt of a joke. And so he is, you know, he has it in for Kimmel, I think, in that way. But like Mark was saying, I mean, I think it's a good thing if ABC does not fire Kimmel, because that sets a very, very bad precedent, right? Like, the media is just already going in a direction that is unpredictable, and it just seems very, you know, almost, you know, just the landscape is changing constantly, daily, and now everything is these sound bites with social media and TikTok and all of these, you know, so it would be very dangerous if I think they did fire Kimmel, because that would set a very bad precedent. So it was not a great joke. It was in poor taste. I don't think I would have liked it. But that being said, he's free to say it. And that's what comedians do.
Bob?
Yeah, you're a better angel than I am. I actually thought it was kind of funny. But it's...
well, that's comedy subjective. That's
exactly. Unfortunately, at my age, I'm already asleep for 5 hours before Kimmel comes on. So it's not anything I'm gonna watch live.
I'm doing the math.
Doing the math and going realizing to bed at 6 or 7. how exciting I really am. You know, Mark, you raised a couple of really interesting points, and I want to go back to a couple of them. One is, I will admit to Sarah, to you, and to all of our listeners, I have great skepticism about the reported assassination attempt. I see the Kimmel piece. I see the Comey piece as desperate attempts to change the narrative. And right now it's working, right? We're not talking about the fact that gas is back up to the highest point we've seen in years. We're not talking about the fact that we're actually in a war, that is not going well. And as reports are trickling out about the extent of damage at our military installations, I worry about what the casualty count truly is. We're not talking about the Epstein files. We're not talking about the absolute failure of tariffs and the fact that while businesses can seek reimbursement, the citizens who were affected by it, there is no mechanism to regain that money, the money that they had to pay. We're not talking about the overall malaise in the economy. Instead, we're talking about a comedian who Jackie. It's a throwaway joke in some respects. But at the same time, it's now consuming so much of our attention when all of these other issues are out there. And I'll toss this on the table because it's a kind of a theme from that I pulled out from a lot of the articles that you sent us, Sarah. Was as much dislike and heartburn as I have with Donald Trump, I have a growing level of anger towards the secondary and tertiary group who are actually taking his crazy ideas and are leading the assaults on our civil liberties and on our society. Mark, you raised Brennan Carr. A perfect example Russ Voigt, perfect example of people who have come in. We may talk later about a situation from an official in Health and Human Services who is fundamentally threatening to blow up the issue of childcare.
Brazenly, we will talk about it.
These are people who need to be held accountable for what they are doing, and this is I think one of the issues that's going to face this country when Trump personally is in the rearview mirror about what is justice and what is right and how do we hold these people accountable for what they've done or are doing.
Fatima.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just add to some of the things that were said. Like, I agree with Bob talking about, you know, this assault on society and distraction, and Mark talking about patterns and trends, and Jackie also talking about, like, you know, someone being a comedian. you know, speaking specifically about Kimmel, and I have thoughts about other topics that we're going to get to today, but, you know, I feel like we're trapped, like, on Snowflake Island. Like, we're playing Survivor, and we're being picked off one by one, right? Like, the bullies can't take any jokes. Well, they're, like, laughing at the American people, right? But they're making a joke of our country, like, as the world is watching this horror show that we're, like, you know, live streaming to the planet. This administration is mocking who we are as they literally play in our faces, right? We're talking about the same man, Donald Trump, who literally made fun of a disabled man, right? Like, he's not exhibiting any presidential or professional behavior. You know, he's not setting an example. The example that he sets is that of a five-year-old child, and he's reckless, right? This is the same man who vomits garbage, false garbage, that results in people getting death threats, right, that are forced to go into hiding and flee from our home, from their homes. Like those that mother-daughter duo in Georgia that were election officials and had to deal with the ramifications of, like, false narratives about a stolen election and conspiracy theories, right? The same person who repeatedly says racist things. Like, his motto, Donald Trump, is do as I say, don't do as I do. And then in terms of Melania, you know, of all the topics in the world that she could choose with her, like, barely even a platform as a first lady, her topic is bullying. Like, that is just a joke in and of itself, right? The hypocrisy is, like, next level brazen. She's married to a bully, but she herself is a bully, right? Like, I think we also need to, like, think about who Melania is sometimes too, right? She's effectively, by coming out and speaking and complaining about this, she's effectively using her own platform and power to strong arm free speech, right? Like, people like to think that somehow Melania is, like, a trapped hostage in a loveless marriage, like, blinking SOS Morse code to everybody to help us, like, help her get free. But she's 100% on board with all of these things. Like, she's a part of this family that's using their power to silence First Amendment free speech and freedom of the press, right? We've got these, like, cancel culture crybabies who used to whine about whether or not somebody could joke. They felt very, you know, muzzled. And now there's, you know, it's okay for them to, like, spew racist, harmful language. But if a comedian who wants to make jokes, they can't handle that. If we talk about the White House Correspondents' Dinner, you know, because Trump was coming and the Correspondents' Dinner typically would have a comedian as the master of ceremony, like, they got rid of that because they knew Trump couldn't handle any jokes. Instead, they got a magician, right? So, you know, like, Kimmel can't make any jokes about Melania, but Trump is allowed to put out memes depicting Barack and Michelle Obama as apes, right? Like, by design, a comedian is supposed to act a fool, is supposed to make jokes if that's what they want to do, except Kimmel is not the village idiot here, right? But what's at the core of this? The core of this truly is really about fear and intimidation, right? That is their weapon of control, because the best way to hijack power, the best way to commandeer outcomes is putting muzzles on people, right? That's the core issue on the table. We're talking about censorship, fear, intimidation, and authoritarian style muzzling of criticism and silencing voices. And, you know, and what's really going beyond just wanting to get power, you know, if I look at this, the gasoline dumpster fire for this model is really media consolidation.
And well, I just want to follow up on something Fatima said, speaking about what happened at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So they got rid of the comedian. I guess the argument is that, sorry, I just lost my train of thought very briefly. After this happened, after the shooting happened, and he's having the press conference and he's talking about this as part of the job, and, you know, I can handle it, but you can't handle a joke, right? So, right, bullets are being fired in the vicinity where you are, and that's part of the job, and you're prepared to handle that, but you can't handle actually having a comedian do their job.
To me, this speaks to how prescient our founding fathers were in this degree. When you look at what I'll call the electoral authoritarianism that Trump aspires to, that's a form of authoritarianism where elections happen regularly, but they're so manipulated that the outcomes are genuinely uncertain. Sort of, you get to pick you still have to play the game, but you get to pick the referee. And you get sort of more players than the other side has, sort of like in Turkey, if you will. And that's what Trump clearly and many of his acolytes aspire to. But our founding fathers had it right. There's a reason it's the First Amendment in the Bill of Rights that enshrines these rights. And I will say, Bob, I have heard from many on both sides of the spectrum in the wake of the assassination attempt this weekend that they have a skepticism. So I don't want to be disrespectful, but I take that very bluntly as a symptom of the consolidation and the effects that we've seen. No longer can you turn to Walter Cronkite, the New York Times, or the Washington Post, or pick or the Wall Street Journal, right? You listen. I mean, Joe Rogan probably has the largest following of all of those media outlets that I just announced. Obviously, Walter Cronkite still doesn't, but the Evening News. And Joe Rogan may or may not, and the people in his studio on a given day may or may not decide that they're all in on a conspiracy theory. And if they do, that has a real effect. When Donald Trump and Steve Bannon talked about flooding the zone, they weren't just talking about their views. They were talking about flooding the zone in terms of a common shared foundation of facts. And we're losing that in this country because of what's happened. And Donald Trump has clearly been an accelerant. And it's amazing to think about our forefathers saw this coming. And that's why the First Amendment is the one it is. And you can see how what a linchpin it is, free speech is, to the foundation of what we've got in terms of our democracy and why it is so under assault. And that leads right into the Comey case, frankly, along with all of what we've seen from Trump as well. And I agree with Fatima. I mean, the irony or the double standard is just brutally obvious for anyone who cares to see in terms of Trump's use of the airwaves to say what he wants, but his attempts to use the power of his office and of the administration to stymie those who are he sees as oppositional.
And worse, Sarah, and I typically depress everybody on a Wednesday to begin with, but
we started that way.
You know, Mark's points are so important. But there's a couple of other subtexts, and I'm going to go back to the assassination really quickly. It's either one of two things, okay? Either it's staged or it was such a massive failure of security that there should be a blue ribbon panel that's already being impaneled to rip through the Secret Service and the White House about why we had such a security failure. And if you notice, there's not a peep. There's not a peep. So I just raise that as a flag. The other issue that I'd like to toss on the table, because I think it gets into, Mark, exactly what you just said about Comey. I think it also gets us into the conversation about the potential media monopolies.
Yep.
We're going to, you know, part of my vision of 2029 is that we're going to have to put in a whole new antitrust group to look at what's occurred, because they are quietly knocking out all of the sort of parameters or guardrails of government that we used to depend on. And where Mark is really spot on is that they are fundamentally changing media to the point that it's a barren landscape that even if you said, okay, we're not going to allow these monopolies, if you think about what's happened with CBS, potentially what's going to happen with CNN, certainly what's been allowed with Fox Entertainment. I mean, you can't even call them news anymore. We have to rethink a lot of what we thought were foundational pieces to our democracy, because right now they're not working for us. And when I pair this on with some of the reporting, which is disgusting me, out of the Roberts courts and manipulation of the judicial branch, and when I look at what's going on with Mini Mike Johnson in Congress, I have no faith in any element of my government right now at the federal level. How do we clean that up?
Well,
how do
you know,
we?
I'm with.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
No, you go ahead.
Yeah, I'm with. Yeah, I'm with Bob. I mean, I'm as a lawyer, like I am personally disgusted with the Supreme Court. I'm disgusted with the, you know, lack of leadership that we have in this country, and this erosion of so many principles that the country is supposed to stand for. But I think it's also a time for like people to get creative. You know, I'm like when you see the reactions taking place or the things that the solutions that people are coming up with, which I think are usually like non-solutions, like you can't dismantle the master's house using the master's tools, right? Like a lot of people are relying on systems and structures that are currently being used to dismantle the Bill of Rights, to dismantle the Constitution, to dismantle government infrastructure. And then they're leaning on what was there to somehow be a solution to counter what is taking place. And instead, people have to come up with their own solutions, not rely on leaders to solve everything. Not because I'm saying that we need to be this continual individualistic society that, you know, can't like be your brother's keeper. I'm just saying because the power structures that are supposed to be helping, right, the politicians, the elected officials, they're failing us in this moment. And so people need to come up with some other way. And when I speak with people and organizations and trying to encourage people to take action, you know, honestly, I feel like half the time I'm like two Greek tragic characters. Like I'm Sisyphus, like pushing a rock uphill. And I'm also like Cassandra of Troy, like going around sounding the alarm, but people aren't believing it. And because they're part of it is because they're like frogs in this low boiling water, like thinking that something is going to somehow like solve itself or things aren't as bad as they really are, but they're terrible and they're dangerous. And I have a whole bunch of thoughts that I can share when we dive into like media consolidation about how we're ending up where we are. But I think the main thing is it's time for people to get creative and take the bull by the horns.
Fatima Gilliam, Robert Griffin, Jackie Barry, and Mark Whitman are the roundtable panel this morning. You can email the show, panel@wamc.org, and we will return and discuss the perils and problems with media consolidation after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc. Today's panel, Fatima Gilliam, Robert Griffin, Jackie Barry, and Mark Whitman. Our music this morning, I want to mention, is by Nate Smith, who is a phenomenal two-time Grammy Award-winning drummer, composer, and producer. He's the artistic director, relatively new, of the Newport Jazz Festival, and he's playing at the Egg in Albany this Saturday at 8 p.m. The playlist is posted online at wamc.org. You can learn more at theegg.org. Again, Nate Smith, just fantastic percussionist, composer, and music producer, will be at the Egg on Saturday night. Let us now, as promised before the break, speak more about media consolidation. We will start with this and see where it takes us. This from the Washington Post. The $81 billion Warner-Paramount mega merger has received shareholders' stamp of approval, propelling a deal that could vastly reshape Hollywood and the wider media landscape closer to the finish line. Last Thursday, Warner Brothers Discovery said the overwhelming majority of its stakeholders voted in support of selling Paramount for $31 a share. Including debt, the deal is valued at nearly $111 billion, as previously reported and discussed. It's not quite done yet. The acquisition still faces ongoing regulatory reviews. Many critics have decried further consolidation in an industry already controlled by just a few major players and are calling for the merger to be blocked, if not from the Trump administration, which so far seems unlikely. That administration has been supportive of the merger, perhaps at the state level, or through other court fights in both the U.S. and abroad. Meanwhile, shareholders rejected a separate measure Thursday outlining post-merger payments for company executives. Actors, directors, writers, and other industry professionals have voiced unequivocal opposition to the deal in a letter arguing that further consolidation will lead to job losses and fewer choices for filmmakers and moviegoers. Some have called on states, again, rather than the federal government, to fight the deal. Let us talk about the greater ramifications. And we'll start with you, Fatima.
Yeah, I mean, first, also add in some metrics about that nice overview that you provided, right? So it's true that the shareholders rejected what would have been like a golden parachute package for David Zaslav, who's the CEO of Warner Brothers Discovery, right? That pay package would have been valued at over $800 million, right? $800 million for a person who in 2021 made $247 million running the company, and then last year got like over $50 million. But even though the shareholders rejected that, but it's not a done deal. Like that doesn't, it's not a binding vote by the shareholders. So through this merger, they could still decide to pay him that over like $800 million. Another important piece to note about the deal is that this deal, you know, with foreign investors putting $24 billion on the table from the Middle East, that means almost 40% of this new conglomerate will be owned by three Middle Eastern funds, like from the Saudis, the Emirates, and Qatar. But then if you bundle in like the total amount of foreign ownership, it would be 49.5% of foreign ownership. I think that is important when we're talking about, like, this is not somebody buying Coca-Cola. This is someone buying, you know, effectively what shapes what people think, right? And the main thing to keep in mind is, like, those who own the forum own the conversation, right? Like, when you have a handful of companies that own the information airwaves, effectively, they can gerrymander the boundaries of political and public debate, right? They're able to expand from censorship into political coercion and dominance. And what I mean by that is you can look at what happened before with Jimmy Kimmel, right? Like, the fact that he was suspended from ABC, the fact that Stephen Colbert's late night show is being canceled, all of these things are linked, right? It's linked to what the FCC is doing. It's also linked to when effectively, like, CBS and ABC paid these what I'll call bribes for these like frivolous lawsuit settlements with Donald Trump, you know, tens of millions of dollars. That's, you know, that's because they're able to leverage the FCC as an intimidation tool, right? And so when you have like all of this media consolidation taking place, right? Skydance buying Paramount, buying Warner Brothers Discovery, right? Like Nexstar merging with Tegna, which is like the, you know, the TV stations, right? What that means with all of this consolidation is that you're able to blur the lines between news and media, entertainment, social media, technology, privacy, surveillance, security, government. It's all bundled in there together. So when you have corporate consolidation, like that's necessary for authoritarianism to flourish. So at the end of the day, what this means is we end up with the magnification of media and culture, so that propaganda becomes policy. That's why this attack on Kimmel is important. That's why these mergers are important, right? Because corruption and consolidation are at the very root of this crisis, right? It's creating every other problem. So like, I wanna see these mergers stop because I recognize what they're doing, right? My concern with all of this consolidation, like, look at who these players are, like the Ellison family, like Larry Ellison, David Ellison with his son, you know, this Ellison, Larry being the second richest person in the world. He's gobbling up a lot of stuff, right? So he himself, he owns Oracle, right, which is all of our cloud computing that you don't think about, right? But that means that they're doing stuff for every single company and government out there and individual. We're all being touched by Oracle. A man who believes in the concept of the surveillance state because he says it'll make us, quote, better citizens. This is the person who wants to own, you know, he owns Paramount. Now he wants to own Warner Brothers Discovery, right? That's going to move from owning like CBS to HBO to CNN, right? They already own Comedy Central. They already own a whole bunch of properties by getting Paramount, right? That means at the end of the day, what are they able to do, right? They're gobbling up all of this media, right? Film production, video games, news outlets, movies, television, right? Because at the end of the day, what it means is that they can control what we think, how we feel about culture and society. And getting to something that Bob alluded to, you know, before about, you know, how people are consuming, what, you know, what trends are, right? Most people currently consume their news no longer by listening to the radio, no longer by reading the paper, no longer by watching television, right? The majority, over 50%, are consuming it online, right, through social media, through online platforms. But we have this problem where there's 82% narrative dominance on the right for what people consume online. And what I mean by that is when you're consuming something on social media, a podcast, no matter what topic it is, right? It could be about gardening, sports, you know, I don't know, golf, whatever the topic is, 82% of it is conservative, right? And so that is also fueling this expansion of conservative ideology, and that then is influencing political outcomes. So if you look at somebody like Charlie Kirk, that man didn't come out of nowhere, right? Charlie Kirk dropped out of community college because he was backed by millionaires and billionaires. Ben Shapiro didn't come out of nowhere, right? He's not some dude in his mom's basement, like podcasting, you know, streaming stuff. No, he was backed by these billionaire petroleum brothers in, I think, in Texas, right? But then my core concern is that there's like a lot of money being spent on creating ideological infrastructure on the right. And there's very little spent to counter that with ideological infrastructure on the left. So that means the left, with this 82% narrative dominance, with these billionaires backing, with all of this media consolidation, all of these things are interconnected, right? And it means that they're creating ideological infrastructure that has a very different focus from what the left focuses on. Their focus is policy change, political outcomes, right? Their return, their ROI is focused on what is going to change the laws that are influencing society. And it helps if you can also shape what people think to get that sort of support, right? Like through their media platform, right? And meanwhile, the left is focused on these vanity metrics, like how many followers are you getting, how many clicks, are you having like, you know, clickbait, all that kind of stuff, instead of looking at affinity metrics, which is what the other side is more focused on. What I mean by that is sort of like, who is, like, are you getting passionate followers? I have more things to say, which I'll add in, but I don't want to hog the entire conversation, and I'll chime in with some other thoughts later.
Thank you. Who wants to go next in the room? Mark?
I actually don't mind the consolidation. I think
what?
That... look,
really?
Were you listening?
Yeah, I listened. I don't.
I know.
Look, what I think we need to be very careful of is undue government influence. I don't like it when Trump tries to favor one group bidding for the asset as opposed to another, and he clearly did that in this process, and then tried to walk it back. I mind Brendan Carr trying to limit free speech. Those things are prohibited under the Constitution as I read it and should be illegal. The media landscape is so amazingly fractured that claiming that this tie-up presents some sort of antitrust issue, I think, is incorrect. If you look at the most successful YouTuber, Mr. Beast, right? He came not from his mother's basement. He got kicked out of his mother's basement. He had to count to a million in his car because his mom thought he was out doing something productive. There are enough avenues in the world for people to get their media that I'm not afraid of this particular merger. And these mergers typically quickly become unwieldy. And this one is particularly saddled with debt, and these don't have a good history in terms of staying together on a long-term basis. If you look at in 1791, when the First Amendment was ratified, the nation was full of these rags that were – we didn't have the New York Times. We had innumerable number of rags that were published. Some of them tried to hew to the truth. Many of them did not. Many of them were sponsored by individuals with access to grind, and including, by the way, the likes of Benjamin Franklin. And our founding fathers knew this. And what did they prioritize? They told the government to stay out of it because they believed that the populace could sort through this. They were also, most of them, advocates of universal education so that we had a population that was in a ever better position to be intelligent consumers of media. So I think we need to focus on what the problem is. The problem is the undue government influence and the attempts to exercise that influence. The fact that Paramount and Warner Brothers are getting together in today's media landscape where Joe Rogan has a larger listenership than probably the three or four largest platforms in that merger, to me, speaks of a time when I think we need to focus on what the problem is. And the problem is government interference and a populace that's unprepared to properly consume these things as opposed to one particular tie-up or another.
Fatima, right of rebuttal. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm blown away by the response of it, because all of these things are linked, right? It's not just about, like, can Paramount, Skydance, Warner Brothers, you know, Netflix, all these companies, like, put out whatever it is they're going to put out, and then they're just going up against, you know, thousands and millions of YouTubers that get followership. It's about this consolidation and how that impacts and shapes policy, how there's this blurring of the line and the connection between the people that are running the country and the people that are controlling these companies, right? So that means that, because it's not just, you know, the Ellison family, they're also just bought TikTok, right? So they're getting every single aspect. It's not just that, like, are you going to go watch Joe Rogan? It's about when you watch something on a streaming platform, right? They can shape the story in the way that influences what people think. It's next level mind control, in my view, right? Because it's what they want us to think and see and consume. That is what becomes culture. That is what we think about, like, what is history, right? It's whatever they're pumping out there. It's all of this scaffolding about how you understand society, because fiction can become fact. It underscores what is your value system, right? Where we are just accepting and consuming whatever slop they want to drop in. So it's not just about, I think you have to be, the analysis must be very different when we're talking about, is the company producing, you know, shoes? Are they producing washing machines? Are they making beans? Whatever it is. Or do they have this kind of industry where it controls what we think and who we are and how we see ourselves in society, because that fuels political ideology? And it's not just that. If we dig in a little deeper into who are these people, right? So I mentioned before, you know, Larry Ellison, who believes in the concept of the surveillance state so that we can live in some sort of Minority Report kind of a world with Oracle. This is also the family who's very involved in the things that we're doing right now, right? So it's not just that they engage in these bribes to get approval from the government to do things, right? It's not just about corruption. It's about influence. It's about power. It's about domination. It's about policy change and political control. So Larry Ellison, who I'm, you know, is somebody who gave like over $350 million, right? A lot of money, the top donor to Tony Blair, former, you know, leader of the United Kingdom, right? So when he stepped down, Larry Ellison gave him over $350 million for his Tony Blair Institute to go around and spew whatever it is that he wanted to around the world. That would be fine in its own, you know, category, except surprise, surprise, you know, Tony Blair is also tapped to be on that Board of Peace nonsense over there in Gaza. You know, we're talking about somebody who has a political ideology, which is why he acquired the Free Press with Barry Weiss to run CBS News, because he has an agenda. And we are currently at war with another country because of some people who also have agendas. They run countries and they are blurring the line with what is happening with the government. And I think that is very important to point out. This is not Coca-Cola. This is our culture and this is policy. And that is why this is very dangerous. Consolidation is at the root of corruption. It is at the root of moving from a democracy to fascism and authoritarianism. So I can't sit back and be like, I'm cool with it. Like, this is not your regular Wall Street deal, right? And we're also talking about a merger that's going to have 49% foreign ownership. Again, not Coca-Cola, right? This is about, you know, everything is connected. Whether or not we're going to have policies that enable people to live a healthy life, get a good education, be able to put food on the table. Those are the policies that they're able to control by these right-wing, you know, world domination type of people. So I just can't accept that. I'm sorry. I just can't, because I think they are a threat to national security. They are a threat to the Constitution. They are a threat to democracy, and they are a threat to the economic viability and survival and sustainability of the United States government.
Fatima, we are up against a break. The panel this morning, Fatima Gilliam, Robert Griffin, Jackie Berry, and Mark Whitman. We will return to this topic and hear from Bob and Jackie after news with Ray Graff. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke. The music this morning by Nate Smith, the drummer, composer, and producer, is playing at The Egg this coming Saturday night at 8 p.m. TheEgg.org for ticket information. Today's panel is lawyer, negotiator, and advisor to companies, nonprofits, law firms, and business leaders, founder of the strategy consulting firm The Azara Group, and author of Race Rules, What Your Black Friend Won't Tell You, Fatima Gilliam, dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, lecturer of cognitive sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and former Fulbright U.S. scholar to Egypt, Jackie Barry, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. We are speaking of the perceived perils or not of media consolidation, and I would like to begin now with Bob.
Some very interesting comments were made in the last section, and I want to go back to Mark, something that you started to allude to, and it really bothers me, and I think was amplified by what Fatima said. My problem is, I want enough regulation to ensure fairness and a level playing field. I mean, that's where I think federal regulation should be, so that we're still promoting innovation, but there's an idea that there is true competition. And what worries me about a lot of what we're talking about here is the consolidation within just a few people's grasp. And I don't know how we re-level the playing field after this. So how do we build back some of the innate fairness that I feel is being stripped out of the system? I also worry that some of these purchases or some of this consolidation isn't because the intent is for it to be successful. The intent is because they want to go in and destroy elements of the model so that it can't be rebuilt. So in a situation like this purchase, I worry that that part of the target and part of the wink and the nod that went on between the folks that are buying it and the government was that CNN was going to be muzzled, and they're okay with it losing money, or they're okay with what occurred with CBS News in the dire straits they're in right now, not because they think it's a good business proposition, but because they think that this is a way of implementing elements of their planned takeover and making sure that there isn't a way to amplify a voice that goes against them. And I think about what Fatima, you said, and it worries me that we don't talk enough about who controls some of now the basic building blocks of our society. And you know, you talked about Oracle, and let's talk about AWS, and let's talk about Microsoft, and who's controlling who controls data now. It's not like it used to be where we had paper files that you could go back to. And what happens when folks decide that, well, they're just going to control information at its most basic, you know, its most basic level of ones and zeros. And I don't think that our policies and laws have caught up with this, have caught up with where we are with technology. Certainly it hasn't caught up with the capacity of AI. It certainly hasn't even, they haven't even begun to think about what quantum could bring to this picture. But these all have tremendous implications on things like public records. And our faith in public records, and when you have a president that is more than willing to say that the documents that were supposed to be protected as part of both the historical and legal review of his administration aren't part of the public record, and they're in cahoots with the businesses that actually control the ones and zeros, it's really dangerous. And Jack, I'm way out of my lane. I'm a lot into your lane. So let me see. If, you know, and if you think I'm full of crap, that's okay. You're not the only one. I got a whole school that thinks I am.
Go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah,
with that lead in.
Well, so I think I'm of two minds on this, right? So on the one hand, I feel like consolidating issues of decision-making, production, casting, who gets budgets, who doesn't, it could lead to a much more homogenized experience than we already have. And we do, right? Because the plots are somewhat formulaic when you think about, you know, movie theaters. But on the other hand, I feel like, you know, when I think about this merger, I'm not necessarily mad at it, because I think about the movie industry has to figure something out to get people back to the box office, right? So I like going to the movies. I don't know about the rest of you, but I like the experience of sitting in the theater and chomping on my popcorn and my candy, and it's dark. And, you know,
I'd love to talk about it for the rest of the show, how much I love it, but that's not what the people want. Go
okay,
ahead.
Okay. But, you know, but I like getting immersed in the experience. But the problem is with all of the different, you know, streaming services and different options for viewing movies, people are often turning to something that's easier. They're maybe looking at a movie or something on their laptop. You know, so imagine watching like North by Northwest on your laptop. You're not getting the same experience there. But you know, ever since the COVID pandemic, you know, the people going to the box office has been down something like 25% to 40% ever since then. And I feel like this is a pastime. It's an art form that we have to figure out how to continue to support, right? So just like going to Broadway, or just like going to the museum, or just like going to the opera, or going to the ballet. Sorry, Timothy Chalamet, but just like going and
he, you know, should be sorry.
Yes,
I think he is.
But, you know, like, and I think most of us in this room are somewhat spoiled, because if we do want to go see a Broadway show, we can just pop down to the city. But imagine if you live someplace else, if you lived in, you know, let's say North Dakota, where you don't have access to as much art. You know, the movies really is kind of the first line of where you're going to see what artists have to produce. Now, I am, again, concerned about, you know, a lot of alternative producers have been, you know, making content that is great. And so consolidating it is very dangerous. But at the same time, you know, I guess it's something that we should continue to promote as a as something that people do. And I lost my train of thought. Right. Sorry. And so then and also I think that movie theaters are also really focusing on trying to get us back by having us more involved in the experience. Right. So I don't know if any of you have ever been to one of those 4D movies, but there's ways that you can be immersed in it. You can have smells, you can have feelings, you can have like, you know, your seat rumbling and stuff. And
I don't like that as much.
Right. So, I mean, this isn't the same as going to a ball game. And they've also changed the food. You don't just get popcorn and candy. You can get, you know, hot dogs and pizza and all sorts of stuff. So so I guess the point is, you know, I don't know what to believe, but I think if Ellison is true to his word that they're going to produce 30 full feature length films every year, and then there's going to be a 45-day wait period before that film can then be shown, then if he is true to that, then there would be I wouldn't necessarily be against it. So from my perspective, it used to be that way, right? It would be 6 to 9 months before a movie was in the theater. Then you had a chance to watch it actually on your laptop or on your screen at home. Now it's almost
DVD or VHS.
Right,
exactly. Even longer.
Exactly. And now it's almost instant. And so from my perspective, you know, I'm not necessarily mad at this. I think it's dangerous, and I support that the actors got together and they wrote a letter talking about how harmful it could be. It would lead to fewer opportunities for people who were in the industry. You know, but at the same time, I feel like it could be good to kind of get people going back to the movies.
Can I jump?
Let me read a few listener emails, and then we'll go to you, Fatima. Thank you.
Okay.
Sam says, I think people, especially Americans, like charismatic speakers. If you have a large apparatus behind you and regulatory oversight, it gets harder and harder to spout off on things that sound good for a second but don't make sense or are inflammatory. With a broad audience, there are more toes to step on, but what is more dangerous? One big loud propaganda machine or 1,000 whispering vipers? I hope we can teach people to protect themselves from any kind of manipulation. We heard from Jen, who says, I love all, Mark. Stop thinking with the Wall Street side of your brain. That's the directive I'm from from Jen. Says, I love your comments and insights 99% of the time, but please recognize that we are in trouble because of all the monopolies that are being allowed. Forget the media consolidation for a second, but let's look at others. Facebook eats up every other competitor. Google reigns over our searches. I cannot remove certain apps from my dongle or phone. Local hardware stores are taking over big box stores. Mom and pops are being eaten by Walmart and Amazon. We need serious intervention or we'll be heading deeper into the next gilded age. And I thought finance people agreed that we need to thrive on competition, not consolidation. We also heard from, let's see, this is from Richard, who says, with all due respect, I believe that the issue is not government interference on the media landscape, but rather corporate interests influence upon, if not outright purchase, of governmental regulatory apparatus. This regulatory capture is taking place to an extent that rivals the blatant corruption, again, another mention of the Gilded Age. In retrospect, this was a key objective underlying DOGE, eviscerating the mechanisms of regulatory oversight. And that was from Richard. Fatima.
Yes. I want to pick up on, and I agree with many of the things that the people wrote in about, but I want to speak specifically about also the film industry. You know, I alluded to before that I'm from California. That means you end up with a whole bunch of friends and relatives that are in the film industry, including, you know, my sister, who worked on John Wick. She's worked on a bunch of, like, big films.
Cool.
It is a job loss bloodletting going on in Hollywood right now. The answer to restarting or giving, you know, shooting life into the film industry and the entertainment industry is not consolidation. That is not the pathway. It's against, you know, what all these people who say they like capitalism, espouse, right? Because what consolidation is going to bring is higher prices. We see that as our streaming prices keep going up, right? You're going to have higher prices. You're going to have a worse product. You're going to have job loss. You're going to have lower supply. You know, they say they're going to put out 30 films. What, 30 more, like, Marvel films? 30 more, you know, like, Rambo-type movies? Like, whatever it is that they think is going to be, like, the most monetizable product, it's not going to be like the thriving creativity of films that we loved from the past, right? Like those creative, interesting films, those are dying on the vine. And part of that is because of this consolidation, right? Like consolidation is a creativity killer, right? It's an industry killer. It's a job killer. And so I think, like, I agree that I want to see something change with what's happening in the film industry. I want people to go to the movies. I want people to be able to say, you know what, I want to be a filmmaker. I want to be a director. I want to be the lighting person, whatever it is that they're going to do. But this is not the pathway to getting there. And what I think is really important and critical in this moment in time, because I'm clearly in the camp that's saying, like, I think this is dangerous. This is a threat to democracy. It's a threat to the industry. It is a threat to creativity. And it's, you know, effectively hijacking and buying the government by powerful, wealthy, deep-pocketed interests. People need to start taking action, right? People need to start pushing against this. Like, I don't want to see this merger go through. I would love it if the European Union blocked this merger. I would love it if the attorneys general across the country came together and blocked the merger. Just like they were like, okay, the federal government's not going to go against, like, Ticketmaster, Live Nation. We'll do our own thing, right? And I've spoken to some, you know, attorney generals. I'd like, please sue. Please block this, right? People need to stop consuming their content, right? And what this also means, like, people should just pick up the phone, call their assemblyman, their senator, their congressperson, their governor, their state attorney general, and ask them to block the merger, right? What they should also do is try to get creative on their own and figure out if there's a way to come up with some consumer-faced lawsuit, right, where groups or organizations are suing to somehow stop this and explore whether or not that's legally feasible, right? Because this media consolidation, that is how democracy is going to die. That also means that people need to support independent media, like the station that we're all talking on right now, right? NPR. It means, you know, ProPublica, all of these different news outlets support independent media. That's one thing. But it also brings us back to the thing that I mentioned before. What do I think is a core piece that will help counter this is that we have to build ideological infrastructure on the left that is laser focused on what is going to galvanize people into action and what is going to influence policy and political change. Ideological infrastructure. We don't have it. They do.
Just to mention very quickly, public media giving days are this Friday and Saturday. Jackie.
Yeah, I agree, right? Like, it sets a dangerous precedent, and there are some independent films that can get through. And maybe consolidation isn't the right way. I don't know. That's not my area of expertise. I just believe that, from my perspective, this is something that is a gateway. And there was a period of time when it wasn't just movies you could go to the theater and see. There, you could see other forms of art in the actual theater. You could see ballet. And this is an opportunity to spread art throughout the rest of the country. But they're going to have to figure out a way to do it because it's just dropped down so much ever since the COVID pandemic.
Bob or Mark?
I continue to be more concerned about not so much the film industry, but the consolidation of wealth and power in the hands of a very, very few number of people, and the impact that has on our overall society. I will go back to something I said before, and I just want to note for everybody that I believe it's as of this Friday, the Department of Homeland Security runs out of money to pay its people again, again, we don't seem to be talking about, even though we've got the World Cup, which is the largest international sporting event coming to our country within 6 weeks, and it's the hurricane season that's starting. I have so many concerns about where our government and our governmental agencies are, and that's something that I don't want to get lost in the conversation about which movies are going to be out or which studios might close. I mean, to me, fundamentally, what they've done is that they've knocked the constraints or the ability even of governments to protect us by what's occurring right now. And I'm not sure how to fix that. I'm not sure how to level the playing field. And that's something that I think is deeply worrying to me.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Today's panelists, Mark Whitman, Fatima Gilliam, Robert Griffin, and Jackie Barry. Let us discuss something happening in one of the governmental departments now as we pivot to discuss Alex Adams. Alex Adams, who you may or may not have heard of or absorbed the name as of yet, is 5 months into his job as head of the Administration for Children and Families, which controls about $25 billion in child care and preschool funding for some 2.3 million poor children in the United States. And he's preparing what he has said will be a, quote, bonfire of regulations. When he arrived in D.C., he told his new staff that regulations for child care should fit on an index card in my back pocket, according to two people who heard him make the remark. Among his top targets for the regulation bonfire, the most sweeping overhaul in a generation for Head Start, which provides child care and preschool to hundreds of thousands of the nation's poorest children, Mr. Adams intends to loosen or eliminate the rules that limit how many children can be supervised by each teacher. Conservatives say the change could give more poor children access to service, yet many child care experts say they could jeopardize the quality and safety of that child care. The alterations are expected to affect almost every other aspect of Head Start as well, such as nutrition standards for meals and health standards that require staff to ensure that children get access to medical care. We're going to barbecue a lot of sacred cows, Mr. Adams said on The Imprint, a podcast about family policy. His office is part of the Department of Health and Human Services. Who would like to begin?
I want to put some numbers around this because your introduction was wonderful, but it only tells part of the story.
Of course. It's just an introduction.
Again, at the same time, he's advocating, and I'll give you these numbers in a second, we're talking about cutting back on money that's available to support. So the idea of money that goes to feed poor children whose families may not have enough money to feed them, being able to subsidize daycare so two parents can go out and work at minimum wage and still not have enough money to pay for the basic bills, let alone housing costs. And again, I will juxtapose this with this conversation about billionaires spending billions to buy to buy companies that we just had.
The money is in the wrong places.
Well, and let's go there for a second. Part of what this dude is advocating for, I want you to think about this at home, okay, is that one child care provider, again, who's being paid a minimum wage, could spend a day supervising up to 6 infants, or up to 9 2 to 3 year olds, or up to 13 3 to 5 year olds, or 25 5 to 13 year olds. And you know, I fundamentally have a problem with this idea that somehow the answer to our child care problem is that the lazy healthcare workers should be taking on more children. That would give access to it. That's not the answer at all.
It's hard enough to take care of one infant for one day.
Well, let alone six. I mean, you had to take care of 4 infants right now just on this panel, and you're ready for this show to be over.
Hardly. But a good joke.
But you look at it and you think, okay, this is really cruel. But then when you have the president who's coming out and saying, well, we don't have enough money in this country for daycare. But at the same time, at the exact same time today, we've got the Secretary of Defense, who in my mind is completely unqualified to hold the position, is up there advocating for an increase in defense spending, which they don't even know what to do with. Where are we as a country, Sarah? What are we about? And this, to me, again, gets back to the other parts of the conversation, is that buried within this administration, there are cruel and vile people who are carrying out elements of a plan, whether it's purposeful or if it's their own warped sense of what reality is, that are fundamentally destroying elements of our community. But in many of the cases, what comes down to is the poor are getting poorer, the rich are getting richer, and this worries me long term. You want to talk a national security concern? Is that when people don't have enough, are working more than enough and hard enough, and they still can't make their basic needs? That's when you start to see civil unrest.
Yeah, I agree with what Bob said. It's something like a couple more numbers, $1,100 to $1,400 per month for daycare, you know, and that's just for one child compared to how much we're spending currently on, you know, on the war. You know, this budget is not very big. And this, you know, these programs are proven. They're proven to work. And as an educator, like, the ratio of adults to children is very important. Like, even at the college level, when you have too many kids in a classroom, it's really hard to engage with each of them individually and making sure that they get exactly what they need. So, you know, I completely agree. You know, child care is a real issue. A lot of families are left because of the policies that we do not have in the United States as compared to some other countries. They're left to fend for themselves and try to figure out how they're going to make it back to work. And as a result, most women in the United States, they don't take as much maternity leave as their counterparts elsewhere because they have to go back and they have to make money. You know, I ran into a woman one time. She was schlepping her granddaughter, who she was babysitting, with her down to a chemotherapy appointment. So imagine you have to go and get chemotherapy, and you're bringing your young grandchild because daycare isn't afforded in the family. So yeah, I mean, I agree with Bob, and I think that just this is a case of it's like warfare against the poor and the have-nots.
We will return to the roundtable panel after this news update from the BBC. Your panelists, Jackie Berry, Robert Griffin, Mark Whitman, and Fatima Gilliam. Welcome back to the roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, on air this morning with Mark Whitman, Jackie Berry, Bob Griffin, and Fatima Gilliam. We are discussing planned changes to the Head Start system in the United States, and we will return to the topic and start up again with you, Fatima, if you don't mind.
Sure. You know, I just think what's taking place is just an example of more destruction from people who will probably never have to rely on the programs that they're overseeing, right? We need people designing policy who experience using these kinds of policies because it will produce stronger outcomes for the American people and more robust, you know, policy platforms. You know, this is why I believe we need to get money out of politics. This is why we need to remove the ultra wealthy that are governing things. I don't know what Alex Adams' financial background is, but he's still advocating a policy and a stance and a platform of, you know, an ultra wealthy lens because, you know, that's who he works for. So I'm tired of this sort of, you know, who designs and influence the policies are the ones that have no personal connection. But this is out of design, right? Like, and the bottom line is these people don't care about families, right? They don't care about working people. You know, they pretend to be family first, but they're actively creating the conditions that make having a family financially impossible, right? This is like beyond being economically counterintuitive, but it's dangerous and reckless, right? They basically, like, you know, this guy's in favor of like getting rid of training programs for foster parents, right? That's just going to fuel like more neglect and abuse for an already traumatized foster child population, right? Like they are not for appropriately caring for vulnerable children and making sure people get training, right? They're eliminating, he's fine with eliminating child care subsidies that will enable people to actually go to work, but instead wanting to manufacture the conditions that make families spiral into economic decline, right? They want child care providers, as Bob was like pointing out the numbers, right? They want them to look after more children, right? Like who can manage even like two infants at once? Like that is just, you're hitting your head up against the wall and you're exhausted. You need a break, right? But that means it's going to lead to like abuse and neglect of children. You know, and I want to share a story with you. So I've lived overseas before. I used to live in France, in the south of France, in Paris. And so I visit France a lot. And I remember one time I was visiting a friend of mine. And so we're going to meet up for lunch. And she had a small toddler. So, you know, like it's like in the States, you assume you're going to meet up with your friend with their child. And it's going to be like a mommy and me day going to a restaurant or whatever it is that you're going to do. That is not how it played out. Right. So I meet her at her apartment. And, you know, we load up the little kid in the stroller and we walk literally like two blocks away. We walk into a school and she like leaves her kid there. And I'm like, oh, I thought we were all going together. And she was like, no, like this is the like the state childcare that I'm allowed to use even when I'm on maternity leave. And she was like, and I use this time to go grocery shopping, for me to sometimes take a nap so I can be a better parent, for me to focus on getting back into the workplace after my maternity leave is over. Like that is a better model. That is how people can thrive, right? Like people talk about the United States being a free country. We are not free when you are perpetually stressed out about economic realities that make it difficult for you to have a family and pay your bills. But so my question is like, what is their point? What is Alex Adams' point? I don't know what it fully is, but what I do know is that cruelty is part of what these folks are about, right? And I hate to like go there, but I'm clearly like a candid person on this panel. I also find it very hypocritical that these are the same type of people claiming that they're family oriented, claiming that they are Christians often, right? There is absolutely nothing Christian about what these people are doing when, if you were to read the Bible and understand the teachings of Jesus, right? These people are not fallen angels that have lost their way. They are implementing sinister plans by design and intent, and it's terrible.
Amy wrote in to panel at WAMC.org and says, this is not only warfare against the poors and have-nots, or the poor, she didn't say poors, and no one should, the poor and have-nots. It is an infuriating attack on women in this country. Project 2026 asks women to have more babies, and its policies are all about cutting back every single support system to help women. Child care, health care, and on and on. Teresa wrote in and said, one adult for nine infants is insane. The ratios are based on safety, specifically fire and other reasons for evacuation safety. In New York State, it's one adult every two infants. An adult can carry an infant under each arm during an evacuation. The ratios go up as the age and ability of the children do, but the number proposed by HHS for toddlers and young children are still very unsafe. And we heard from Vincent, who says half of American families are living paycheck to paycheck, and 67% of families report being financially distressed. Meanwhile, billionaires are controlling more and more of our government and economy. It's another tale of two cities in the making. Mark.
I would just emphasize, and I think my fellow panelists have touched on this, this whole controversy represents two areas where the administration is offsides with the view of the American public. Number one, on affordability. The rise of childcare costs.
So that's a made-up word and concept.
Yeah,
it's brand new and not real.
Yeah, that's right.
Sarcasm.
I got it.
I know. I'm telling the listeners in case you're not the only person I'm talking to.
So if you want to emphasize, you know, the issues of affordability, one of the big increases in costs that families face is childcare. Now, some of that's because the nature of our society has changed and people move away from relatives and they're less likely to watch children. Whether that should be or the other should be the ideal state of affairs, I don't know. But in order to get two income earners into the economy, you got to cover childcare. So the administration is certainly offsides and exacerbating that issue with the way it's treating American families. And the second is around immigration. The story that we read talked about all the documentation that the administration has asked for while nominally trying to make it simplify regulations. And what they're basically trying to do is throw people out of subsidized childcare and reimburse less. Part of that they want to do if a child has one or more parents who are irregular immigrants. The fact that you have one legitimate parent, presumably, or potentially in one, not legitimate, but one who is legal status in the United States is beyond question, and one who's may be in question would make you ineligible is a little mind-numbing for me. But it does raise the issue, where the heck do they expect the next generation to come from? These particularly of employees.
These people,
particularly less so Trump, doesn't have a well-formed idea of sort of let's increase the birth rate for all sorts of reasons, including in J.D. Vance's. J.D. Vance has one, and it's also based on promulgating Western society, in his view. They obviously don't want to let in immigrants, which if you think about it, what is a working age immigrant? It is a preformed adult that you haven't had to that is given to an economy from another economy once they've reached the ability to contribute economically. So I don't know where these folks expect the next generation to come from if you total up all of their policies. And I think the fact that they are so offsides on affordability and with respect to the demographics in this country, it leaves me befuddled, and I think the panelists are right to search for other explanations, including cruelty and mismanagement, frankly.
And I think, Mark, you put your finger on one of the biggest conundrums that I have about where we are right now as a society. It's so irrational to me. You know, I may have disagreed with past administrations, but I could pull a string of at least understanding an approach. I didn't always necessarily need to understand it, but where we are right now with this administration, and frankly, this administration being allowed to change rules and laws by fiat rather than by act of Congress. Again, I'm back on beating my drum that I think some of the biggest traitors to the American experience are these current members of Congress. You also, I mean, I thought you were going to put your finger on another issue with immigration too, is that how dependent our society is on the immigrant community for our care, both our medical and our child services, that we're knocking out again these important foundational pillars of what the working economy has stood on. I struggle with where this comes back to.
Yeah, just one quick point. Not only where are they going to come from, but like, what kind of shape are they going to be in when they arrive, right? So, like, you know, Head Start kids compared to peers of similar economic backgrounds that don't have the opportunity to participate, they have better behavioral and emotional regulation. They have better engagement with their parents and with their peers. They are 2.7% more likely to graduate from high school and 39% more likely to graduate from college, right? So we are only increasing, you know, how well off we can be going forward. It just seems like it would be just such a benefit to our society if we invest in this generation rather than trying to shunt off the few that we don't like, that belong to families that we don't like.
Which feels so obvious, right, when you say it that way. I mean, yeah. But it's an ongoing, of course, battle. Mark?
I would just, on the issue of affordability, I would just recommend to the listeners, and I have
You're before, off mic, babe. Thanks.
I would recommend Michael Green wrote a piece on Substack titled My Life is a Lie, How a Broken Benchmark Quietly Broke America. And it talks about affordability. And it is an imperfect but yet very powerful and insightful piece explaining what it is those who are more economically vulnerable feel in terms of economic vulnerability. Why it's evolved to the crisis that it's at, how the government exacerbates it by taking away supports as people earn more money trying to climb out of those what we'll call economic holes. And I think I would refer people to it to better understand. It certainly was an eye-opener for me when I read it. And again, it's Michael Green, and it's My Life is a Lie, How a let me see. I can't find the title now, but it's basically how a broken measure broke our economy is the rough. And it's in Substack, and you can get at it for free, and it's long, and it's worth the read.
Fatima, do you have anything to add before we move to a new topic?
Sure. I'll just quickly say that I think that their game plan is self-harm for the country. Like, that is what they're doing every single day. All of these things is not what enables economies to grow, but it stunts an economy. Like, we are amputating what basically fuels growth, innovation, and an environment where people thrive. And because we back these kinds of policies and we're trying to, like, amplify them and make them even worse, like, these are the types of things that are at the root of why we have a mental health crisis, why we will continue to rate very low on any kind of global happiness spectrum, right? And that we are okay creating a society where people don't have coping skills. And instead, we're like crabs in a barrel scratching to survive and, like, mentally make it through the day, right? If you're going to start at infancy, creating an environment where people aren't healthy, that speaks to all of those statistics that Jackie mentioned, this is the way to do it.
Panel at WAMC.org to participate in the conversation. We have one more underwriting break before the end of today's panel. Let us take it now and then come back to you. The panel this morning, Fatima Gilliam, Bob Griffin, Jackie Berry, and Mark Whitman. Bailey, are you ready for the break? Thank you. We will take an underwriting break now and be back with you momentarily. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. The music this morning is by Nate Smith, two-time Grammy Award-winning drummer, composer, and producer. He's the artistic director of the Newport Jazz Festival, which has an outrageously rad lineup this summer. And he's coming to The Egg in Albany, New York, this Saturday at 8 p.m. The playlist is posted online at WAMC.org. Our panel this morning, Fatima Gilliam, Robert Griffin, Jackie Berry, and Mark Whitman. And this will probably be the last topic for this morning. Let's see. Former FBI Director James Comey was indicted again on Tuesday, that's yesterday, this time over a social media photo of notoriously hard to say, straight out of a tongue twister, seashells arranged on a beach that officials said constituted a threat against President Donald Trump, this from the AP. The criminal case is the second in months against Comey and is part of the Trump administration Justice Department's relentless effort to prosecute political opponents of the Republican president. The photo was posted nearly a year ago, but the indictment was secured at a time when Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche, a Trump loyalist who previously served as his personal lawyer, aims to prove the president that he is the right person to hold the job permanently. The fact that the Justice Department pursued a new case months after a separate and unrelated indictment was dismissed could expose the government to claims of a vindictive prosecution and to arguments that it's going out of its way to target Comey, who as FBI director has overseen the early months of an investigation into whether Trump's 2016 campaign had coordinated with Russia to sway the outcome of that year's election. That was a decade ago. It feels like a million years ago and also yesterday. Time is a lie. Next, what do we want to talk about regarding this Comey indictment? I'll start with you, Bob.
Again, I think this is we continue down the path of misuse of government services, misuse of government power, misuse of executive power. Honestly, the case is crap. And as a taxpayer, what really bugs me is that the Department of Justice know it's crap. And at the end of the day, when Comey sues the government and gets the rich payout, guess whose tax dollars are going to fund this continued little temper tantrum from Trump and his buddies? It's you and me, because Trump doesn't pay taxes.
Mark, Jackie?
I just want to emphasize, I want to add, it's no accident that they Todd Blanche, Cash Patel, and the other folks added in the kicker of an arrest warrant for Comey, just a little cherry on the sundae for Trump, so that they could have that hanging out there. What a week for Cash Patel. If what I saw in the videos from that shooting, from the attempted assassination over the weekend, by the way, I'm with Salad Guy on that one. Cash Patel did not exactly carry himself as the head of the FBI under those circumstances, but that's okay, because he's proving to Trump in yesterday's news conference with Todd Blanche that he can take on the seashells and defend Trump. It's gruesome to see that guy. And I guess the question is it he or Hegseth who goes next? We should start a bet on that on the round table.
We're not betting on the round table. No gambling on the show. Go ahead, Fatima.
Yeah, there's good. Well, I agree with everything that Mark said, but I'm also going to say the quiet part out loud, right? So first, I totally think what they're doing with Comey is totally illegitimate. Their goals are nefarious. You know, they're just seeking revenge, and they want to punish him because Trump is on a revenge tour. But for the candid, part, Comey is getting run over by the karma bus, if ever I saw it. You know, this is what he invited. I'm not saying it's right, because it's totally wrong, and I don't want the government to do these things. I don't want it to do what Bob talked about, right, how, misuse.
Oh, lost. We've lost you. Can you hear me? Now I can hear you.
Yeah, we got you.
Sorry about that. I was just saying that, he's getting run over by the karma bus, if ever I saw it, right? He invited foolishness, right? He was misguided in his judgment. He made poor choices when, as the FBI director, he decided to meddle in the 2016 election when Hillary Clinton was running for president, and a couple days before the election at the end of October, he drummed up the email scandal, and that influenced the outcome of that election, right? And that fueled backlash. I don't think what they're doing is correct, but I do look at it and I'm saying, beep, beep comes the karma bus at top speed, and they're just trying to run him over for his poor choices. But this is what happens when people align themselves with that megalomaniac that's in the White House, right? It's fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. But with this guy, it's fool me once, shame on me, right? We already know who he was even before president, right? This is the type of guy who runs everything like he's some sort of mob boss gangster who likes to use intimidation tactics on people. So I do not believe that it is correct. I think it is terrible, but I also think it's a distraction to something that Bob said in the earlier hour. This is a part of their melee, of their madness, right? We're talking about a seashell photograph snapshot when we have pedophiles facing no accountability. We have corruption on steroids. We're engaged in a war in a foreign country when they did not attack us first. our tax dollars are being squandered on all kinds of buffoonery and foolishness when we've got like some bruised ego, fragile snowflake Trump. Instead of focusing on, like, what is going to make this country better, what is going to enable people to thrive, what is going to enable people to have some, you know, sense of pride in their own country, and this is not that.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything that the other panelists have just said, and I realize we're low on time, so I'll just say it seems to me it's an issue of free speech. He didn't even do the seashells. I think he just took a photo of them, which seems to me that it would be protected. But, you know, don't we have more important things to be worried about? It's a distraction from a distraction from a distraction from a distraction. Like, we are in the middle of a war, and that is where this administration's attention should be focused, not on some social media photograph that was posted a year ago. So that's just my thought.
Bob.
You know, the in so many respects, today's conversation just reminds me of the whole ballroom fiasco. This idea that we're gonna spend our money that we the taxpayers don't have because of affordability issues on an ego project for this guy. But if you think about how he approached it, it's the exact same way that he's approached all of the issues we talked about today. Rip it down first, okay, before there's a plan that's in place, leave a cratered hole that the rest of us then are going to have to pay for. It's symbolic of where we are as a country right now. But at the end of the day, what really gets me is that the taxpayers like you and I are stuck with the cost of this. And he's got a bunch of sycophants around him that are cheering him on that need to be held just as accountable as he is. And we don't need a damn ballroom.
Let us end there for today. Your panel this morning, founder of the strategy consulting firm the Azara Group and author of Race Rules, What Your Black Friend Won't Tell You, Fatima Gilliam. Fatima, thank you for coming back. It's a pleasure to have you on the program again.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation with everyone.
Good.
Thank you.
Hope to hear from you soon. Also, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Thanks as ever, Bob.
Thanks. I'm going to zip it now to celebrate the day.
Zipper day. Lecturer of Cognitive Sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and former Fulbright U.S. Scholar to Egypt, Jackie Berry. Thank you, Jackie.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun.
And investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. Thanks, Mark.
Hope everyone has a wonderful day.
You are listening to The Roundtable on WAMC, and we'll be back with more after this.